I'm Natalie Yerv-Lifker with the Animal House Dateline. Think your dating pool is slim? Try being a gray wolf in the Northwest. Extermination programs in the 1930s and 40s led to their extinction until Idaho reintroduced them from Canada in 1995. So when a wolf named OR7 recently placed a paw in California, there was cause for excitement. Born in Oregon's northern wilderness, OR7 traveled 205 miles by himself across the state to the southern Cascade Mountains, all to find a mate and territory of his own. 3 years of searching finally paid off when he met a black female, origin unknown, and produced a litter. The den is in Oregon, but if the pups are anything like their father, they could wander hundreds of miles south, bringing wolves back to California permanently.
There is an international poaching epidemic that is devastating African wildlife, threatening the lives of wildlife rangers, and creating international security risks that most of us in the United States cannot even begin to understand.
On the other side of the country, the New Jersey legislature passed a bill to stop trade in ivory and rhinoceros horn products. Illegal trafficking is directly responsible for plummeting wild populations of elephants and rhinos. It contributes to organized crime, terrorist organizations, and gun running. The United States is the second largest importer of ivory in the world, and the New Jersey port of Newark is a hub for the international wildlife trade. The New York legislature has passed a similar bill, and if both are signed into law by their respective governors, experts say the ivory trade on the eastern seaboard will effectively be shut down. More information about these stories is at WAMUAnimalHouse.org.
Flocks of green parakeets may seem out of place in cities like Washington, D.C., Chicago, and New York, but seeing those South American natives in urban areas of North America is becoming more common. The presence of these birds is fascinating for some, frustrating for others, and a starting point for a new citizen science project to determine the species' environmental impact. Here to tell us more about what's called Project Feeder Watch is Dr. Emma Gregg of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. I describe them as green parrots. What are they really?
They are really monk parakeets. That's the species. And they're a species that is originally from South America, but they've been introduced into several different locations throughout North America and are becoming more common in especially urban locations.
How do they get up here?
Well, they're also really common and adored pets. And so they were brought up for the pet trade and either intentionally released in some locations or birds just escaped by accident. And these parrots are actually kind of special because they are used to cold conditions, but they also are special because they build really large stick nests. And this is unlike most other parrot species. And potentially having this nesting behavior gives them a little more freedom to live and roost in colder climates than a lot of other parrot species, which are restricted to warmer locations. But unfortunately, in many cases, these parrots build their nests in electrical lines. And you can see that that causes some problems from the perspective of a utility company. So there actually is controversy about whether or not these parrots should be controlled in some locations because of these stick nests that utility companies can't stand.
Do we know how many of the birds are out there? Any idea?
We don't have a great estimate of population size for these birds, but we can say where they're occurring. There's a great resource online called eBird that allows you to just type in a species name, and it will show you all of the sightings that have been reported to eBird within the entire world.
Now, tell us more about Project Feeder Watch. What are you doing?
Well, Project Feeder Watch is a citizen science program that's been run through Bird Studies Canada and the Lab of Ornithology. And there are about 20,000 people a year now who participate throughout the U.S. and Canada. And all we ask is that folks count the birds at their feeders in a systematic way a few times throughout the winter season. So what this gives us is a really good idea of where birds are occurring and how abundant they are throughout North America.
Would these birds be considered invasive species?
They are not a native species, and it's because they're an invasive species that we're really interested with this feeder watch program of figuring out if they have any impact on native birds.
And remind people how they can get involved if they'd like to.
Well, the easiest thing to do is to go to the Feeder Watch website. It's www.feederwatch.org. And there are a couple of clicks that will guide you right to how to sign up for the program.
Dr. Emma Gregg works with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Thank you very much for being with us in the Animal House.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks very much for having me.
Pet owners, of course, will go to great lengths to protect the health of their favorite animals, from regular veterinary visits to complicated dietary regimens to costly surgical procedures. Our next guest falls under the latter category. He's Dr. Greg Lubart, a professor of aquatic animal medicine at the North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine and a pioneer in fish surgery, a relatively unusual practice which is growing in popularity. Dr. Lubart speaks to us from the Durham, North Carolina studios of public radio station WUNC. Dr. Lubart, thank you very much for being with us in the Animal House.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Now, when you say fish surgery, a lot of people probably say, what? How often do you get that reaction?
Pretty frequently, even from colleagues in the veterinary profession.
How'd you get into this?
It's sort of interesting. I was hired here at NC State 19 years ago because I had experience with ornamental or pet fish medicine at a veterinary school. But in fact, some people say, well, you must be an ichthyologist. I'm not. In fact, I'll come clean with you, Sam. I've never even had an ichthyology class. My background is more in invertebrate zoology and some herpetology in addition to what I learned in veterinary school. But back in the 80s when I was in school, I sort of had this dream of working at an aquarium with dolphins and sea turtles, and that was a hard go back then. So I took a part-time job at a local pet store in Philadelphia and started learning about fish and aquariums and filtration. And then fortuitously, the wholesaler that sold fish to this little corner pet store, which was quite successful, offered me a job. I had done a little bit of work for his fish, and he was one of the bigger wholesalers on the East Coast, and he offered me a full-time job as his more or less herd health veterinarian. I was about a month from graduating. I didn't have a job, and I hooked onto it, and I've been doing that ever since.
I got to ask, how does one anesthetize a fish, please?
So what we would do, we would, you know, carefully handle the fish, place it in some sort of a container. It may be nothing more elaborate than a 5-gallon bucket or a plastic, you know, sweater box, something that's secure. Then we add our anesthetic to the water. Then they absorb it into their bloodstream and they go to sleep. And that usually takes 3 to 5 minutes, dependent on the species and the dose. We wait till they basically stop swimming, stop thinning, but they're still respiring. Then we put the fish on a device we sort of affectionately call our fish anesthesia delivery system, or FADS. If you could picture a fountain in your backyard, maybe for a bird bath, that's all it is. You've got a pump, a tube, water squirts out of the tube, and instead of falling into a little fountain or some other vessel, we put the tube in the fish's mouth, and then the water flows over both sets of gills on either side. And then once we have it finely tuned, then the fish is under anesthesia. And the fish is out of water. I should qualify that. If it was underwater, obviously it would make surgery more challenging. So we baste it once in a while with like a little red catheter, or even nothing more elaborate than a turkey baster in some cases, although usually at the veterinary college it's a syringe. And then we cover it with a plastic drape, a sterile drape, and we're set to go. There probably are between 100 and 200 veterinarians in this country now that have done some fish surgery.
You must have sworn off eating fish entirely.
I love fish, Sam. I love eating fish. I got to tell you, it's probably my favorite food to eat. And worse than that, again, I'm just telling you my story, I guess. Worse than that is I'm a fisherman.
Thank you very much for being with us in the Animal House.
Sam, thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Gary Weitzman answers your questions about pets and wildlife next in the Animal House.